everybody. Welcome to the podcast, The Relationships We Live In. I am here with Eric Thompson, and he's going to tell us a little bit about himself.
Hi, Guillermo. Guillermo and I know each other from our long fascination with a body of knowledge that I think contains a lot of wisdom about relationships, very fundamental. So it applies to all relationships, and it's called family systems. I'm a psychologist. I'm a licensed psychologist in Vermont. I started in the clinical world in like 1988, and I've had a foot in it the whole way since then. But about 20 years ago, I started working with senior executives and their teams, and I developed a course, a leadership journey, a year-long leadership journey for executives. And that's mostly what I've been doing the last 20 years. I also get, I go into these work systems. So, you know, let's say it's 500 employees. I get to know the senior team members and I support them in thinking through how they're going to develop great teams, how they're going to develop talent, and also how they're going to overcome high stakes relationship challenges. So it's been a great ringside seat for dynamics in businesses, some of them family businesses. I also moonlight as the executive director of the Vermont Center for Family Studies, where we train family advisors, and I'm really into meditation. So the last thing is almost the most important, like my favorite thing. Meditation has been an amazing 40-year daily adventure for me. I have a lot of friends who are advanced meditators and teachers. I've done a lot of retreats, and maybe we can get into more of that before we finish.
Yeah,
it's a touchstone for me about higher stages of human development, like I mentioned, which I'm absolutely fascinated by, like sustained peace, like where you really just have like a steady state of like joyful peacefulness. You know, like I think we all, we're all on some kind of spectrum there. How much of that do I have during a week? How long, how many hours in a row could I go? How many days can I go in a row where I don't have any bad mood? And not because I'm not engaged in life, not because I'm avoiding life, but just because I'm living in a state of really rich stability inside. That was completely interesting to me, and it still is.
Yeah, you know, Eric, I have a really similar interest in this idea of, well, sustained peace while engaging life. I didn't call it sustained peace, but this idea that any realization that you have, any shift in the way you perceive the world, or if you feel like you had some revelation, it has to translate back into life, into the world. Like you got to take it back with you.
Yeah. Like not stuck in a cave or something.
Yeah. I find it fascinating.
Or I would say, you know, stuck in a book too. Some knowledge just gets stuck. It's stuck in the book. It's not really flowing out into human interaction.
Very true. How did you get into meditation and TM?
I mean, when I came out of high school, kind of lit up about it.
Out of high school?
Yeah, I read some books. I had some experiences that made me think there's something else going on here with life. Spiritual experiences of the inner subjective state that these books were presenting as possibilities for humans. And I made some friends who were also really into it, and some of them were older than me. And one of my friends had gone to Maharishi International University, which is an accredited university in Iowa that the TM organization started in the 70s. And I was like, I want to go there. And so I went there, and my teachers there were meditation teachers, and they also had like PhDs in literature. I studied literature. I'm kind of crazy about literature. I love novels. I just read War and Peace last summer.
Really?
Oh my God, I love that book.
I gotta read it. And I've only
Tremendous
read an excerpt.
wisdom. There's wisdom in these ancient, in these old books.
I think so.
You know, so anyways, I got a literature degree, but I also got an advanced degree in meditation. That's what they did there. You got both.
Fascinating.
Retreats around meditation teachers all the time. So that was the start of it.
Then you stuck with it.
I did. It wasn't hard to either. It was easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
And
not a strain. It wasn't like a forcing. It wasn't I gotta do this today. It's more like, oh, how I would never want to go a day without doing that. It's like ice cream. You don't have to try to eat ice cream. You don't have to try to enjoy chocolate ice cream. That's what meditation, I mean, and I'll say transcendental meditation is really like that.
yeah.
People repeatedly who do transcendental meditation will tell you this. It's just easy. Easy and enjoyable.
That's is that am I right? That's characteristic of TM. It's like a it's not a pressurized system.
Absolutely. One of the key descriptors is effortless. The practice is effortless. I have a lot of respect for mindfulness. I have really good friends who do Vipassana meditation, one of our colleagues. When you hear him describe it, it is not effortless. It's an effort. And again, I respect that. I mean, I have a lot of things in my life that are an effort, but the meditation that I do is not an effort. It's actually a sophisticated effortlessness and allowing. That's one of the reasons why I've been doing it so long, Guillermo, because I'm not that disciplined.
I've been reading that book you suggested, Into the Silent Land by Martin Laird.
Yes.
Loving it.
Are you?
About Christian meta not meditation, it's contemplation.
But
Contemplation.
I would say this Martin Laird, who was a Villanova professor, I wonder if he knew the new Pope. He's a very good writer, distinguished Catholic scholar. And that book, I think he knows about transcendental meditation because when you read that book, knowing what I do, there's a lot in it that is it's very, very similar to the language used in transcendental meditation. It's the closest thing I've ever seen to that outside of the transcendental meditation literature.
It's interesting.
It's very interesting. He's very nuanced in his discussion of the practice. Yeah. Into the Silent Land by Martin Laird.
The cool title too.
Father Martin Laird.
I
It
like
is a cool title. Into the Silent Land.
your
That's
comment.
the fundamental of transcendental meditation is that there is a, they call it the least excited state of the mind. Least excited state of the mind, which is a metaphor from physics. Because physical systems like electrons, they have different levels of excitation in the states they're in, and they have this physical, in physics, there's this description of a state, a least excited state of the physical matter. A little bit beyond me, the physics of it, but I know this is true. So they use that language to describe the state of the mind, least excited state of the mind, which is the transcendent. Silent, inner silence. It's a little bit hard to imagine.
It's incredibly hard to imagine because we're so packed with energy all
Yes.
the
Busy, busy.
time. Yeah.
Mind busy, 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 racing around.
You know, sp speaking of that, how does that how has th it sounds like you came to the meditation before the psychology or psychotherapy aspect of it.
Sure.
How did the what about them connects for you?
I mean, they both involve the quest for a good life, you know, and the recognition that a good mind is required for a good life. You know, it's how we see the world. The world is as we see it. You know, I think Guillermo, the great poets, could look at a tree and they'd see a lot more there than the average dude. And they see infinite beauty, in every leaf. And they both drive towards that, psychology and meditation. They both drive towards that.
I like that. And good art. Great art.
Agreed.
I know.
Agreed.
You were talking about the poets, and what came to my mind was the I love the Impressionists, Impressionist painters that could
Oh,
see
wow.
all the whole
Crazy.
spectrum of life in a single thing.
Crazy.
Isn't that
The
Blake?
beauty of a Monet painting, if you ever get to stand in front of one of them, especially one of the large ones. I went to the Met a long time ago and stood before one of these things. It's like, that's why they're making a million posters every single day. Because that thing is radiating with life and beauty. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, go to families. Like, families are so beautiful. There's so much wonderful things that go on between family members, but it can be such a tangle and so painful. And so that was always so interesting to me. Just I guess I just had a craving for family happiness. Which can be elusive.
Happiness in the family, in one's relationships,
Yeah, it can be elusive.
What makes it what do you think makes it so damn difficult and elusive?
I like the big question, Scammer. That's a big one. I mean, I think that the natural state of humans is a lower stress state than we're currently operating in America. And that the natural state of the family is appreciation and harmony. But we lose our ability to operate that way when stress starts to overwhelm us or creep deeply into our mind and culture. Fear, craving, desperation. When these things start to creep into our mind and into our culture, they creep into our families. And then this thing that we all need so badly, which is to be in a harmonious, supportive family, it almost turns against us because we're so sensitive to that and we're so hungry for that, that if we don't get it, we can go nuts.
It's true, yeah.
Kind of nuts
Yeah.
and get pretty chaotic. Bowen, I think, was trying to help with that problem. Murray Bowen.
In what way do you think?
I don't know that much. He didn't write an autobiography, but I had the intuition that Bowen knew something about family health, that he had a deep feeling for it. And then when he became a psychiatrist after World War II, he, went into the clinical world at Menninger's and he saw how much these families struggled. And he was on a mission. He wanted to help. And the model that he was, the big model of the day was Freudian psychoanalysis, which is kind of amazing, fascinating. Byzantine body of knowledge, and they were using these techniques, and he just was like, these are they're not working well enough. They're not helping these families enough. And he looking for a better model. Extremely creative man with a vision. And he took a crack at it, making a better model for families, I think.
Rooted in is this what you were talking about, like the harmony, not harmony, like we want that and we strive for it, but we don't have it, and that creates friction in the relationships and plays out in different ways in families and in individuals.
Yeah, I mean, you could say in a way the body of knowledge is an exploration of how chronic anxiety disrupts family health. That's a fundamental dimension of his.
How chronic anxiety disrupts family health.
Yep.
And just could you define chronic anxiety or give like a brief description?
Sure. The technical definition that I memorized is it's a response to anxiety is a response to real or imagined threat, and that the chronic anxiety comes in when the imagined threat gets bigger and bigger. So you got the real threats. The whole threat response system in the human is ready to go to deal with those. It's automatic. That automatic system that, gets your heart pumping when you might need to run. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to decide, to have your heart pump. But that process, if you insert a lot of imagined threat into that, now you got chronic heart disease. Heart's pumping too fast, too much. Doesn't shut off. Doesn't stop. And then, what's the mental side of that is fear, chronic fear, chronic anxiety.
Yeah. Would you say that's what most clients come in that you've seen with some version of that, some version of an imagined threat or?
That's a good question. I mean, that's probably pretty basic, right? That almost everyone who comes looking for help from a priest or a psychologist or a marital therapist, that's probably somewhere down near the core of it, is an excess of imagined threat.
Yeah. Something like I don't know, a root one might be that I'm not good enough, and I'm
Yeah.
not doing enough, something
That
like
could certainly be a version of it. Yeah, like an unrealistic assessment of how well I'm doing. It's unrealistically negative, persistently negative, negative self-bias. Yeah. Yep. Somebody said something related to this. I thought this is a good one to contemplate, that the solution to all problems is to come to realize that there is no problem.
sounds like
It sounds Pollyanna, but don't throw that out so fast. There's
yeah.
something to it. There is something to this. It's kind of an ancient saying.
It's like a koan almost.
It's a puzzle.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting because it doesn't guide you so much to solving the problem on the level of the problem. Like let's just say sex and marriage. Can we, talking a ton about sex or learning about sex? I guess that's all good depending on where it's coming from. But if it's coming from this fundamental, fearful, anxious mindset and a panicky feeling, about not getting enough sex or the wrong kind of sex or sex is not right in my marriage. Let's say it's natural fluctuations, ups and down fluctuations in a interest in sex. And someone's panicking every time it fluctuates downwards.
Because it's activating something for them, some fear.
Thing we were just talking about. Like
Yeah.
this is actually a real problem. You could dive into it and try to solve it on the level of the sex, but if you took that ancient saying that Mahavakya, great wisdom, that the solution to all problem is to realize that there is no problem, and realize that this is actually not a really that big a problem here. and try to even embrace that and live with it for a while. Like to think about it, like the problem is that I'm perceiving a problem. And that's potentially a better solution.
Yeah.
And you're gonna get more sex.
And
Trust me.
maybe better
Trust
sex.
me. You're gonna get more sex. It's a funny, paradox or irony.
I love
It's
a good
attractive,
paradox.
to be,
Huh?
it's attractive to be in control of yourself, to be in balanced state of mind.
Yeah,
Attractive.
absolutely.
Yeah.
That goes back to the quieter mind that you were talking about, you know,
Yes.
quieter mind.
Yeah. Quieter mind, more present for others.
Yeah.
Less needy mind. Needy mind is a busy mind. Quieter mind is a more independent mind. I'm thinking about parenting, just pivot over from sex to parenting.
Yeah. Well,
So
they go together.
many parents are. That's profound. You got that right. Oh, wow. That's a good one. I see so many parents really struggling when their kids are launching and they're panicking about it. And to some degree, there's a natural grief, but I see some parents like kind of a little bit freaking out. Same thing, the kid's moving away, and I'm seeing that as a really big threat. And it's hard for me to enjoy that. And we both of us probably sometimes trying to help parents just go, hey man, just breathe through that a little. They're going to come back if you
Might
let
be back
them
sooner than
go. They won't run from you. A lot of parents go through a learning journey on that when their kids are, probably 14 to 24. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of that letting go as somebody becomes their own person.
Let them go. Let them be their own person. Same with sex and marriage. Let them go. Let them have some distance from you. Let them have some space.
Yeah.
If you can let them go with a lot of graciousness, they'll come back.
You talked when I talk to people. It's so hard for people to let go because it's like it says something about them in some way.
Yes.
If I let her go, she doesn't love me or he doesn't love me or something like
You
that.
coach people to help them see all that and get a little more wise about it. Or,
That's the goal. Yeah.
yeah.
Absolutely.
Says something about me. Just like you said,
I was. Oh, no, keep going. Go, go, go.
Well, I'm gonna throw this phrase in. So Fred Travis is one of my favorite scientists. He's this transcendental meditation neuroscientist, and he's a neuroscientist of higher stages of human development. And he wrote a paper where there was a model presented about the degree to which people are embedded. My sense of self is embedded in objects of experience. In other words, there's the experiencer, me, the object of experience. Right now, I'm looking at Guillermo on a screen. I got my half and half over here. There's a picture of my wife over there. How embedded is my sense of self in her? If it's deeply embedded and she moves away, the threat is profound. It's to my sense of self, not just to something more surface. It's a threat to me, to what I am. I think you were sort of pointing in that direction. And so and his model, is if you're less embedded, your sense of self is less embedded in objects of experience, including, of course, people. You're a whole lot happier, a lot more equanimity.
You know, I think this goes back to the paradox you were talking about, Eric. How is it that if I'm less embedded in another object, another person, that I can be have a better relationship, that less embeddedness actually allows me to have a better, it seems like a contradiction.
It could sound that way. I mean, it makes me think, Guillermo, some people have their North Star for relationships as intimacy. And they kind of rate the relationship week to week, how much intimacy we have. And I get that. I think that's very normal, natural. We all want to have a profound feeling of being embraced, and feel very connected, like they get me and I get them, But if it's, I'm not sure it's the best North Star because of what we're talking about. That you don't want to be too in what? You don't want to be night white knuckling the intimacy game. You don't want to be desperately attached to moment intimacy. I think that is a poison of long-term victory in lots of relationships.
I hear you. I think if that's when people get really sensitive to tone of voice, to he said this, it must mean this, or she said that. They start keeping score of things, and frictions build up in that, I think.
That connection between intimacy and what we call differentiation is a kind of amazing mystery to me. And I think it's the final word has not been written about this. It's interesting.
Would being less embedded be in something like, if I'm more solid in myself and my identity is not totally wrapped up in the other in some way, then I can move into intimacy or be out of it if ride the wave of intimacy in a relationship a little easier, more fluidly.
Right. I mean, like I put it, the waves, it's a very natural image, the ocean, the tides, and we have tides and waves in every human relationship. But it's like our amazing Bowen writer, Michael Kerr, Dr. Michael Kerr, one of my favorite pearls from him is that people all want the same thing. They want adequate emotional contact and adequate emotional space.
Good luck.
it's a powerful thing to think of that people, they crave both of these things. And that space, like everyone can relate to it when you say it to them, it's folksy. Yeah, I want adequate emotional space. I want a little bit of room to breathe. I want room to be me, right? But I also want intimacy. And those, I think, are like the trough and the what's the top of a wave? You're down
The
there in
crest of the
the
wave.
crest and the trough of human ocean, the ocean of human relationships are those two things. And they're always at play. And yeah, like if you're attached to one or the other too much, so you're gonna get knocked around because the waves are gonna keep on coming. They're not gonna stop,
Oh yeah.
you
I, how do you help how do you help people think about that? Shift, cause I think people come in, they tend to be focused on the other person. Because of what you're describing, that
I mean,
attachment.
like in a clinical situation where they're coming in looking for help about a relationship. Yeah. I'm thinking of a wonderful person that I had the fortune to talk to some years ago. It's exactly what you said. They were a very thoughtful person, but the main topic was the marriage and the worries in the marriage. And the how do I get her to stop distancing? That was the preoccupation of his mind when he first started wanting to talk to me. I mean, how do I do it? I mean, probably we all have our own ways. I'm sure you have very well developed. I think one of the things I do is try to explain the fundamental principles to them in order to help them understand that how they manage it is the game. And that lots of people make such things worse by overreacting to them, and that's the real enemy. Like, I mean, I'm kind of passionate about marriage and helping marriages to be happy and to be sustainable. So I kind of like to lay out for people the big threat here. The big destabilizing threat is not really what's happening, it's how you react to it.
The reaction can sometimes be worse than the thing in the moment.
You can make this thing worse very easily.
Yeah, I've seen it.
I sometimes like to play with them a little and point out like the way you're talking right now could definitely make it worse. Or they tell me a story and I said this and I said that. And I say to myself, ooh, you probably made it worse when you did that. Made it worse. You don't want to make it worse. Not making it worse is a significant contribution.
That's true, actually, yeah. Not making it worse is a significant contribution. Not getting caught up in the escalation of it, of whatever's going on.
Fuel on the fire. If you don't fuel a fire, it's going to go out. It's going to go out every time. We live we have woods right around our house, so there's a lot of brush. You have to deal with brush. Trees fall down. So we regularly have these little bonfire piles. And the same process now, I've done it so many times. You make the pile, you let them dry out, and then you burn them. And you pick a day where there's wet around, you set it on fire. And it's amazing how long these things burn. So they'll be flame, they flame up and then they get settled down and then they stay hot. And I've gotten to the point now, I'll go to bed, I'll go out there and double check, triple check, but it's still hot. And there might be one log still in there, but I know what's going to happen. That thing is not going to flame up again because there's no fuel there. It's pretty similar.
I hear
It's
that.
a part of like, how do you let nature work for you in these situations?
That's I like that. How do you let
I think of
nature?
it back to Kerr, that natural instinct that I want adequate emotional space. I mean, I think for a lot of guys, let her have the space is a pretty good mantra. Like they should print one of those t-shirts for every groom. it's not every situation. Sometimes it's a little different than that, but
But it's a good
it's
go-to.
not the only thing, Guillermo, right? It's not the only thing, but it's a lot.
It's one that comes up often.
It comes up often.
Don't try to manage her to make yourself feel better.
That's even better. It's more general. I like that. Don't try to manage her to make yourself feel better. That's so basic.
It's so damn hard.
Can be.
It can
Oh, it can be.
be.
I just tell you, like I told you, my marriage is going great. 5 years in.
25,
Solid.
25.
Solid as a rock. We're very happy. And recently, something unfortunate happened to me. And it's called Downton Abbey. My wife is so, she has an incredible ability to get into a book and read for hours and hours. And the same thing happened with Downton Abbey. So I was a Downton Abbey widow, man, for like a week. Listen to me whining, okay? The girl was watching end-to-end episodes, and I turn into a baby. I did. Absolutely. I was a whining baby.
me some attention.
Where's my wife? What did I do well? It's not my first rodeo, so I was able to recognize. I actually had some self conversations. I said to myself, okay, you're starting to get pretty worked up. Eric, wait 3 days. Just don't say anything. In fact, you better start making plans. I said to myself, what are you going to do? How are you going to have 3 good days? You're not going to see her. Pretend she's in a different country. And this is me managing myself and trying to do exactly what you said. Is to own it. And I like to tease myself and say, man, look at you. You are quite a baby. You can't even handle this. Your big problem in life is Downton Abbey. And that's me teasing myself in kind of a healthy way, I think. And again, not making her the problem. Not going in with guns blazes about how wrong it is that she loves this TV show, which would be easy to do. This is wrong. What you're doing is wrong, and I think I did okay. I'm going to give myself a solid B minus. I focused on other stuff. I set a good, it was good the 3 days, not 3 hours, 3 days, Eric. This is a little thing. It's not, some people would say, God, first world problems, Eric, and I would agree with them. But I would also say that this skill set is one of the reasons why this marriage is a very happy one. And I could give you more intense examples of other things we've been through. Same skill set.
I was just thinking, I don't know if it's just a first world problem. It sounds like a human problem, this sensitivity to somebody being distant from you.
Oh, I'll bet hunter-gatherer dudes were in the same
Yeah.
state as me.
Like, what the hell? I just killed the tiger for you.
Yeah, or how about what the hell? You want to go visit your mother over 50 miles from here? What are you talking about?
We gotta walk 5 days for that.
You're gonna walk over there and I'm staying here? No.
So
Like to
true.
tease us guys about what babies we are.
Oh yeah.
So attached.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Eric, you made me think. I was thinking about you earlier, and you have a playfulness where you can take serious things and bring a lightness to them.
Thank you.
No, it's true. My sense is that's really imp I think it's a really important in general to be like it's a great skill. But how did you get there? How did you develop that?
I mean, it takes me back to TM. So the framework that the meditation is supported by, I would say, is the idea that it's our birthright to experience like the springing forth of joy just from being. That being itself is joyful. And it's a proposition about the state of the universe, world that is asserted in the ancient Vedic tradition and in many other traditions. It's a universal wisdom, and that's all philosophical abstraction, but the meditation creates a conduit to the spring. And that you can experience in meditation, and you don't try to with TM, but it happens regularly, a sort of springing forth of the joy of being in your own heart and in your mind. So that experience leaves you more independent of the external joys of life, less attached, less grasping to them, because you have a fountain inside you. There's the famous stories of sages who imprisoned, and they have meager, they don't have access to anything good externally, but they still are in a state of joyfulness. You know, there's Bob Dylan wrote a beautiful song about that. So I think that ability to enjoy the ride, to, you know, you complimented me, I appreciate it, of the playfulness, being able to have a little fun with it. I think that's a big reason why I've become more cheerful as time has gone on, is that thing, that promise, kind of worked with
Yeah.
this meditation.
Yeah.
You know,
I
I
love
do feel
the
like a kind of a background sense of bubbly that's growing. It's people have known me for a long time have said this to me too. Like, you know, you're just more bubbly than you used to be. Used to be a bit of a downer, Eric. You know, my bros might kind of punch me in the arm with that one. You know, I think I could get heavier more easily in the past. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you reflecting that back to me.
Yeah. I appreciate I appreciate that you have it, you know. I like this that image of of like a fountain within oneself, you know, that you can tap into, you know, which is probably related to some kind of universal fa transcendental fountain or,
That's the proposal of this ancient philosophical tradition, that, you know, it's that being is not emotionally flat. It's not emotionally empty. It's actually emotionally full, being itself. And that there's a universal self, that in almost you could say the universe has a self. It's a wild idea. We all know I have a self. Like, that's obvious for people. Oh, I have a self. I mean, does my family have a self? The whole family? I guess maybe it's a little easier for people to go there. Yeah. Well, yeah, it kind of does. My family has a self. My family has moods. My family has ups and downs. How far out can you go? Does the sun have a self? Is there something like a thought that the sun has? Maybe it's like, I warm. I don't know what the sun's thoughts would be, but very serious philosophers, panpsychic philosophers, ask this question: does the universe have something like a thought? Does the universe have consciousness? Is the universe conscious? And the Vedic tradition comes in with an answer. It says, yes, it does. The universe is conscious, and its emotional quality is joy. It's pretty wild, you know? And again, it could sound pretty Pollyannish to some people, but
It sounds beautiful to me.
I think it's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's got a poetry in it. It's got a ring of truth. Some scientists say they can really go physics on you with that. And on bottom line, you know, and maybe this is where we wrap for today, is if you have the direct experience of it personally, that's all the proof you need.
Ain't that the truth? Ain't that...
I
What, by the way, what's the Bob Dylan song?
was thinking of I Shall Be Released.
That's the one that came to mind for me. I see my light come shining from the west down to
I
the
see
east.
my light
Yeah.
come shining from the west down to the east, because he's in a prison cell, so the light's coming in through a window, and instead of it starting in the east, it starts in the west and moves over to the east. I don't know, I always felt that in that song, that this guy is in that prison, but he's very hopeful. Any day now, I shall be released. He's living in a state of hope. You know, that's how I relate to that song.
Yeah. I
Yeah,
love it. I
it's
love it.
beautiful. Another one is Cordelia in King Lear. She hits the same note
Yeah.
as old Bob.
Like one of her monologues.
Yeah, at the end, her and her dad are in a bad spot. They're in a cage, and they're about to get killed. And she shows you how free she is with her speech. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Hey, man, it's been great talking to you.
You too,
Really
Eric.
enjoyed it, Guillermo.
Me too, man. I really,
Appreciate it.
we'll see you. We'll do it again soon.
Okay, man.